Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf. It's that time of the week when we talk about politics and all the forces affecting it. And of course, normally we talk about things like polls and different situations in different states and get the perspective of different players. This time, what we wanted to do was get a little bit of a look at one of the big forces that drives American politics, and that is the right-wing media. We are joined with that in mind by Nina Burley. She is a journalist, best-selling author, documentary producer, and a contributing editor to our friends at The New Republic. She also publishes the political Substack, American Freak Show. How are you today, Nina?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you, David?
Very good. Well, I have a little headache, but I think this will make it go away. So let's start with a discussion about a subject you write about extremely well and frequently, and that is Fox News and the impact Fox News has. I think one of the things that has drawn me to your coverage of it is that you not only write about its influence, but you've also written about some of its recent stumbles. But let's start with the man at the center of it all, Rupert Murdoch. What is he, 93 now or something like that?
I think he's 93. I don't know. I should know when his birthday is, I guess, but I don't. He's either 92 or 93.
Yeah, no, you won't want to miss sending him some kind of a gift, because not only has he got a birthday coming up, he's got a wedding coming up. And almost as if you and I were sitting here writing a screenplay about all of this, he's marrying, I think, the mother-in-law of a Russian oligarch who is close to Vladimir Putin. His ex-wife was close to Vladimir Putin. He's close to Vladimir Putin. And somehow, this seems like one of those stories that just never resonated. I find it bewildering because, of course, of the ties between Trump and others in the GOP and the Russians, and the fact that, oh, by the way, the Russians are our enemy. But, you know, maybe I'm just hypersensitive. What do you read, if anything, into Rupert's marriage? Besides, you know, when you get married at 93, it is truly, as somebody once said to me, a triumph of optimism.
Yeah, triumph of optimism on the wife's side too. Well, I'm actually just starting to write an article for New York Magazine on that very topic. So I'm beginning to understand a little bit about how it came about, but it's still kind of a mystery. I think that you know, like a lot of old guys, you know, I have an old dad. I think a lot of old guys.
Is your old dad marrying a Russian oligarch?
No. But he does have a younger wife. And, you know, I think a lot of older men, well, most old people don't really want to be alone, but I think especially men. And I guess that he has, you know, he almost married the dental hygienist, I think she was, last summer. Remember, he had a 2-week engagement with the woman, again, also met out in California. And it was you know, the family put the kibosh on it, I guess. And then because she was too, she actually had too many financial entanglements with the ex-husband or something. And then this one is just, you know, keep it all in the family, man. I mean, it's his, the mother of his last two children introduced him, that's Wendy Deng, introduced him to Elena Zhukova, the woman that he's engaged to now. And as you said, Elena is the mother of Dasha Zhukova. Elena was a, you know, in the Soviet Union, she was, you know, like a lot of the women, you know, educated women, has a degree in a science degree. She's a molecular biologist. She came here with her daughter right before the wall fell. She managed to get out, and they moved. She was a professor at Baylor University, lived in like a little, you know, one room house or something in near the university, raised the daughter. And then her ex, Zhukov, ended up being one of the, you know, the men standing around when they privatized everything, and he became very wealthy. And so his money trickled down so that when she, her colleagues, she ended up at UCLA, her colleagues in the molecular biology department were, they knew that she came from quite a bit of money, but they weren't quite sure like what its source was. And then her daughter, Dasha, of course, as you mentioned, married you know, one of the big oligarchs, Abramovich. That lasted for a while. And so Elena is, as you said, what is the ex-mother-in-law of one of the top Putin oligarchs. And then Dasha, they divorced and Dasha remarried a Niarchos, a Greek shipping heir. And I guess has kind of gone under the radar a little bit. She's not quite as social, but it is a mystery, you know, why. I mean, he courted her last summer, reportedly, on a yacht called the Christina O that cost $750,000 a week to rent. So that's the kind of world. I mean, everybody who's watched Succession understands that this is these are the yacht people. They're not like civilians. They don't live like we do. But when you look at that number and you just think about it for a second, he just blew $750,000 on a pleasure cruise. And that's who she's marrying. And I guess, is she going to be able to get, you know, one of the questions, like, is she going to be able to get any of that money? He's, you know, got one foot in the grave. The family can't be happy with that. And they aren't even letting the younger daughters in. So it's just kind of hard to tell, like, you know, Michael Wolff's books about Murdoch, he always makes the case. Now I've never met Rupert, but he has, and he makes the case that Rupert has a lot of charm, and that doesn't come through in the photographs. It certainly doesn't come through in his product, right? Which is, you know, right-wing insult comedy, and you know, it's not anywhere near fact-based information, and in fact, it's doing enormous damage to the Democratic world. Fox News, I wrote about it for the New Republic, a couple of months ago. And it stands now as one of the, you know, it is obviously going to be Trump, the candidate. But Fox News is the other adversary to Biden in this election year. There's no question about it.
Well, yeah, I'd like to get into that in one moment, but I just feel compelled to ask, you know, here's Rupert Murdoch. He's marrying this woman. She is part of the Russian elite. Should we say, gee, that's cause for some concern? That's curious. You know, the fact that his prior wife was also close to Putin, is there something we can glean politically from this? Or is it just that oligarchs will be oligarchs. They hang out in the same yacht basins. They live in a world unto themselves. And if you're, you know, a big Western, you know, media mogul, you're going to end up hanging out with a bunch of, you know, Russians who sort of stripped away the assets of the Soviet Union and are now super rich themselves. That's just the way the world works. Or is there a political underpinning?
I think it's the latter. I think these are, you know, these people are stateless, essentially. This kind of wealth, it crosses borders. And they're not like us. You know, he's Australian. He's an American immigrant. But he's not. This is stateless money. And it's a lot of money, and money seeks out other money. And I think that, you know, I mean, he's also hanging around with David Geffen, right? So there, it's not just, you know, it's the yacht people.
I mean, although it does pose the question, why is David Geffen hanging out with him? I mean, you know, I mean,
well, David, I guess, you know, let's go back to Michael Wolff claims that Rupert Murdoch has charm. I don't know. I mean, I don't, he, you know, Wendy Deng, he hangs out, David Geffen hangs out with Jared and Ivanka. So like his choice of friends is, right. I don't know David Geffen. Hopefully he'll talk to me about this, but.
Well, no, you make a good point because Jared has no charm. I know people who've worked with Rupert Murdoch. They say he has some charm. But of course none of this would be relevant if it weren't for Fox. If it weren't for the fact that Fox is this behemoth in the American media landscape. I think it may be relevant that the owners of Fox are kind of stateless, and they're playing a cynical game to countries to which they don't have particular loyalty, whether it's Australia or the UK or the United States. But let's talk about Fox for a little bit, because you've written a number of good pieces for it. And I think the one I saw most recently was in the New Republic in December or something like that. Because if I take your most recent pieces, I get two stories. Fox is an opponent in this election. It is very powerful. And it is somehow less than it used to be. And the question is, how much less and why is it less? So maybe you could address those.
It's somewhat less than it was before the Dominion lawsuit. Not so much because they lost their, you know, they lost, what was it, $750 million in the lawsuit, but because they lost their, you know, I guess part of the settlement, or, you know, Rupert Murdoch used the settlement, or the Fox leadership used that settlement to get rid of Tucker Carlson, who was their big draw. And so that's a big loss to them. And it's not a company that can really, it's not making the move into streaming quickly enough for the investors. So there are problems with that. Investors themselves were upset about the, you know, $750 million doesn't mean that much to Rupert, to the family, but it does mean something to the value of the company. And so you can see that Wall Street has downgraded a little bit since that happened. And it's not just because of that; it's because of the lack of moving into the streaming world. But they're still raking in enormous amounts of money on cable fees, and that's their audience. So, and it also still has a great deal of influence, as you know, on, you know, numbers. Millions and millions of people watch it, and only it, and regard it as their source of news. And when I did the article for the New Republic, one of the things we wanted to do was just kind of look back over, you know, how he came to the United States, how this messaging machine was built, how he got, you know, I mean, he's an extremely dangerous individual as an immigrant to this country, because as you see, he's built this company that's going directly to the heart of our system. And what happened was, he came over here in the late 80s, and at a time when there were four networks, if you counted PBS, and the right was unhappy with the liberal, what they regarded as, the liberal views of these television networks. And so when he came here, it was quite clear what he was doing in the UK and what he had done in Australia. He had created this model of feeding people what they wanted to hear and calling it news. And he was on the right. And he came here, and what he did was, FCC had, he's a foreign, there was opposition to him setting up this company here over time, but he had these aide de camps and these conciliaries from the right who shepherded him through the licensing system so that he bought up all these, I think he got 20 or 29 local broadcast licenses. So he was, established himself that way. He established his company that way early. And then the big sort of win was getting Sunday football. So you put together this kind of, the right-wing propaganda, and then you put it together with, couch potatoes watching television, watching football on television on Sundays. And it's sort of like one of the former FCC presidents said to me, it's like, didn't Circe turn Ulysses' men into pigs? I mean, that's what it was. Like they just sat there on the couch and they're watching football. And even with the sound down, you've been in a bar or restaurant or a gym, I'm sure, where they've got Fox running in the background. Even with the sound down, the chyron, the red, emergency alert news story, emergency alert, Biden falls, or, migrant caravan is coming, or blue cities in chaos. And it's brilliant. I mean, Roger Ailes was part of that, putting that together, and it goes straight to the cortex. So that I watched it to write the article, I watched it for a few nights in a row, and you can see the system that they have. They divide the screen into three. They've got what really are insult comedians like Jesse Waters. I mean, part of the loss that fought losing Tucker and replacing him with Jesse Waters is that Jesse Waters is just a clown. I mean, Tucker's kind of a clown, but he's a super dangerous clown, and he's more alert to political movements. And Waters just doesn't even get it. He just spews like this ridiculous word salad about conspiracies, but you don't even really need to listen to him because you've got the chyron. And then in one corner of the screen, they're running like 24/7, over and over on a loop, iPhone video of, a fight that broke out on the southern border, right? Or a bunch of people breaking the fence, or they get video from the subway in New York City of some kind of mayhem. And they run it in a loop with this chyron, and they're just feeding fear straight into the cortexes of these, mostly rural white voters who were watching it, or anybody who's got it turned on even with the sound down. So there's that. And I think it's still an extremely powerful operation. It was from the very beginning in the 90s, they did a study when it really kind of established itself on cable. I think it was Harvard. They did a study on a couple of counties where Fox had been introduced, and they found that it affected voting patterns, and that more people voted Republican after 4 years of having Fox in the cable system in their counties. And now it's everywhere. It's a messaging machine that's in lockstep with the Trump Heritage Foundation movement. One of the other ways they lost control, though, is that you could see it with with the speaker when McCarthy was run off, and during that period, you could see they're kind of, they don't have as much control over the congressmen. These, you know, the Freedom Caucus isn't spouting exactly what is on Fox. They've gone further and further, and Fox has had to chase them as they chased Trump and then got out in front of him until he lost.
Well, that, you know, that was one of the questions that I had, because the origins of Fox and the origins of Trump are interrelated. Roy Cohn was one of the people who helped Rupert navigate his way into the United States, and also at that time, helped do little things like connecting Trump to Roger Stone and so on and so forth. And clearly, Ailes and Trump had a kind of strange, if tortured, symbiosis that led to Trump's elevation. But there did seem to be some tension within Fox around Trump. And periodically, Fox will say something like, well, you know, the U.S. economy is actually growing pretty well under Biden, or, there is a Trump trial. And so there was a sense like, are they distancing themselves from him? But do you see that as illusory, and that they're actually sort of lining up where they were before?
I do. I disagree. I mean, I think you may have heard them say that the economy is doing okay under Biden. I think that when I was working on this piece, there was an enormous amount of positive economic news coming out in the last part of the last quarter of 23. And it was unbelievable the way they spun it. I mean, you know, there would be this great news about unemployment, and they would either spin it as, this is Biden manipulating the numbers, or they'd even have people come on and say, well, you know, the numbers look good, but this is just a sign that socialism has come to America. I mean, literally, those were their Wall Street experts saying that. Maria Bartiromo is one of those people. I mean, they will never back down on Biden. They're finding things to blame Biden for, even when there's good news. They do cover the trials. Obviously, they try to do that. They can't fully ignore them, but they're certainly not giving their viewers. A full picture of what's going on. And I don't think that they're going to back down. I think that Rupert Murdoch did not like Trump. There are lots of quotes in many publications about the names that he's called him. He was disgusted with him at the end. But, you know, what happened was Fox became, you know, Trump, after Ailes died, Hannity became sort of like the Trump whisperer for Fox, and Trump was running the network at least in a messaging way. They would pick up his sound bites and run with them every day, and I think that that's maybe crumbled a little bit, not because of the big lie, which they were sticking to, but because of Trump himself, and because of the, what's gone on in the House with the Freedom Caucus and the kind of mayhem and chaos and these crazy, crazy, crazy people that they've got in there that they really can't keep on, and nobody can keep on message. But in general, I don't see them backing down at all. I think they're going to maintain focus on, seeing Biden lose, and they spew uncorrected falsehoods every single night, all night long. I mean, I'm not watching it all day, but follow Julia Jeske on Decoding Fox, a terrific, every day she puts in, 4 or 5 hours watching it, or Aaron Rupar, some of these people that just, they're logging it, and they're just telling lies constantly. They do not run corrections.
Let me, we've got a few minutes left here. I'd like to shift the subject a second to something that has been quite striking in the past few days. And you mentioned just before we came on that you'd been doing some work on, and that is the financial hocus pocus surrounding Truth Social. So here's Truth Social. It's a company that is failing by any metric of a company, losing money, not building its audience. And here's its owner, Donald Trump, who needs a lot of money. And all of a sudden, out of left field, comes this SPAC, this kind of stock qua fund that's got some cash. And it says, oh yeah, we're gonna buy Truth Social, we're gonna merge with it, we're gonna become the Truth Social Media Company, we're gonna change our stock market ticker to DJT, the initials of Donald Trump, and which I believe was also the stock market ticker of like his
bankrupt company.
His bankrupt casinos.
Yeah.
But you know, they ignored all that. And all of a sudden, this company that was worth less than nothing is theoretically worth billions of dollars. Trump, who was in a financial slump, is all of a sudden got the potential down the road of turning his big, big share of this into a lot of money. The owner of this, the principal owner of this SPAC, that is a guy who is a big Republican donor, who also, by the way, happened to be a big early investor in ByteDance, which is the owner of TikTok.
Are you talking about Yas?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so all of a sudden Trump is like taking a pro TikTok view. But it seems to me like a giant scam where anybody who's got money in this at the end is going to lose money. And where Trump can effectively, I mean, what he's done is, to my mind, something kind of diabolically brilliant. He's created a call option on the potential next president of the United States.
It's an end run around the FEC. It's an end run around what is left of our post-Citizens United campaign finance regulatory system. And you know, you could see it coming. Last week when they started talking about it, I suddenly understood, oh, this is just another way for favor seekers from Florida to Abu Dhabi to put in some money and get their chit out in case he gets elected. And so that's exactly what it is. It's its value, you know, and it is sort of the ultimate Trumpy business, because all of his businesses rely on this, like, you know, the smoke and mirrors, the branding, the, you know, the pump and dump of the Trump brand. And that's what this is. It's a pump and dump. And he's going to, now the only thing holding back is that he's got, you know, the SPAC rule is that you have to hold on to your stock for 6 months. So he supposedly can't sell it, but he certainly can borrow. I mean, he theoretically can borrow against it. There may be some regulation about that too, but the board of the company that he's just created can waive that rule. And who's on the board? Who do you think is on the board? Donnie Jr., you know, other pals of his are you know, going to decide whether or not he can sell it. So, you know, once again, this is another example of how this man exposes and uses cracks in our system that we, you know, aren't aware of or weren't aware of until he came along. And it goes for the legal system, as you know, and you know, that's what he's doing with the legal system. The Republicans working for him are probably in these counties in Pennsylvania up here. They've had 4 years to go around and find every single, you know, statistically necessary county in all these states that need to be slightly manipulated, and they know where those votes can be gotten and where they can be, you know, how they can challenge the system. You know, all these counties in Pennsylvania, I'm looking out the window at Pennsylvania where I am, they all have different rules. They all have different commissions on each county, elections commissions, and they've already started. Last year, they were already in Lucerne County, which is this kind of bellwether Trumpy MAGA county, where the MAGAs had taken over the Elections Commission and changed all the rules so that now it's all MAGA. And those are the people who are going to run the 2024 election. That's my main concern. I have a gut feeling that Trump will not be able to win fair and square, but I really worry that they're it's going to be tight and they're going to be able to pull off these, because they've spent so much time, elves in these little nooks and crannies all over the country, looking for ways that they can manipulate. It's all local and they're out there.
Isn't there a big caveat emptor here to people who put their money into Truth Social? It is pump and dump. So they pump, we're in the pumping. But ultimately, there's the dumping. And somebody is going to get dumped upon, right?
David, I just was doing some spring cleaning and I came across my files on Trump University from, remember that scam?
Right, yeah.
Look, there are people born every day who are falling for this guy and for this kind of thing. And that particular, the Trump Social, what is it called? The Trump Media and Technology Group or whatever, that is just another, it's another Wall Street, devil take the hindmost. Maybe somebody on there, maybe they will end up, getting something from him. Maybe he'll hand off the nuclear documents that he hasn't given back to the system yet. I don't know. They might get something out of it that doesn't involve him. If he doesn't get elected, yeah, they're probably going to lose their money. But those are gambles that people are willing to take.
Well, yeah, and there are a lot of people around the world who, $50, $100 million on Trump is nothing.
That's right.
It's a rounding error. And that's why I call it a call option. Can we know who those people are? Or are we not going to know who those people are?
I don't think we can know. Unless somebody, I'm not a business reporter and I don't know how you can find out who these investors are. That's why I say it's an end run around the FEC. You already have with Citizens United anonymity broadly granted to these big donors by the IRS, right? So that they don't have to acknowledge who they're getting this money from. And I would think that the investors in that SPAC could be LLCs. They don't have to put their names on, although we do know that Yass is one of the big donors at the moment. And I say donor, I mean investor.
We'll see. We'll see about that. We'll have to continue this conversation at some point in the future when we can determine whether or not they are donors or investors. But for now, Nina's Substack is called American Freak Show. She writes for the New Republic. She's got a piece coming up soon for the New York Magazine.
On Rupert's wedding. See you at Rupert's wedding in June.
Yeah, Rupert's wedding. That's something none of us will want to miss. And maybe we'll have you back to be the Rupert's wedding reporter.
Happy to do it. I'm happy to come and talk to you about it. When that story will be out in a couple weeks.
Okay, well, I look forward to that. And appreciate all the good work. And so we'll see you again soon. And everybody who's listening, we'll see you again soon on one of the many, many podcasts we do here on the DSR Network. Until then, bye-bye.